A Story Publishing presents Steady Pulse. Night settles over London like a stage curtain, thick with soot and the restless glow of fires that refuse to die. Listen closely. An air raid siren rises, trembles, and floods every alleyway with its metallic wail. Anti-aircraft guns crack the darkness, their tracers clawing at bombers hidden by cloud and smoke. All along Whitehall, shards of glass tinkle on the pavement as though a chandelier has crashed across the city. The smell is unforgettable, a mingling of cordite, wet brick, and the faint sweetness of singed paper from a bookstall that moments ago stood intact. Out of this night strides Winston Churchill. Picture him in that familiar camel hair coat, collar flipped high against the cold, cigar glowing like a miniature beacon. His gait is deliberate, not the spry march of a younger man, but a determined shuffle that signals something essential. I will face what my people face. Around him, stretcher parties navigate craters. A boy of maybe 12 scampers past with a bucket of sand, intent on extinguishing an ember before it births another blaze. Churchill pauses, dips his head under a sagging shopfront, and steps inside. The proprietor, dusty, eyes glistening, stands among broken biscuit tins, too stunned to sweep. Churchill lifts the man's chin with a look rather than a hand and says simply, "We can take it," four words softly delivered. Yet the shopkeeper inhales as if oxygen has suddenly returned to the room. Out on the street, a small knot of neighbors gathers. Some recognize the Prime Minister's face, others only sense that authority has arrived. A few minutes later, Churchill moves on, and the whispered refrain trails behind him. "We can take it, we can take it." What just happened? A leader entered a scene saturated with fear, and without promising safety or victory, transferred his own steadiness like a live current. That transfer, the psychology of borrowed calm, will guide our journey through this audiobook. No matter the decade or the arena, crises sift leaders by one trait above all, their ability to anchor the collective heartbeat. For Churchill, the anchor was equal parts theater and authenticity. Earlier that day, before the bombs returned at dusk, he had rehearsed upcoming remarks to the House of Commons. A secretary overheard him pacing the cabinet room, cigar smoke curling around draft pages as he mouthed phrases in rhythmic cadence. "Should the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour." Notice the long note held on thou sand, the pause before "men will still say." These were not accidents. Churchill rewrote speeches by ear, underlining syllables like a composer marking fortissimo. He understood that cadence drives emotion the way rails guide a train. Keep the beat steady, and passengers feel secure even when the scenery explodes outside. But delivery was only half the craft. Composure had to be demonstrated physically. On most nights during the Blitz, Churchill insisted on touring the East End after supper.
A Story Publishing presents Cipher in the Half-Light. The morning broke in pewter half-light, muted reflections sliding down the glass facade of North River Intelligence. NRI for the handful of people cleared to know the name. 36 stories up, Samuel Hollis watched the Ohio River mist crawl over Cincinnati's warehouses like a sheet pulled over an unremarkable corpse. He pinched the bridge of his nose, willing the knot behind his eyes to loosen. The senior staff briefing started in 14 minutes, and his slide deck still felt like a confession signed under duress. He swiped through the last animation, supply routes painted in crimson across the Adriatic, converging on Belgrade like arterial plaque, then hit save. In the process icon, Eliza Koliva's profile hovered for an instant, half smile, half dare. She had uploaded the data pack 10 hours earlier from somewhere near the Danube Delta and then gone silent. Anyone else and he would have blamed spotty Balkan fiber or Rakia and bad judgment. But Eliza didn't vanish. She was too stubborn, too precise. She treated comms checks the way percussionists treat downbeats. Samuel exhaled and tugged at the cuffs of his charcoal suit. Expensive cloth, resale shop, price tag. The narwhal-shaped scar near his wrist caught the light, souvenir of a childhood lathe accident in his father's garage in Schiller Falls, Ohio. Even now, he could smell the WD-40 and sawdust of those evenings, hear cicadas buzzing beyond the roll-up door while he passed wrenches to a man who believed a life was measured in things repaired. He forced the memory aside and headed for the briefing room 3 corridors away. Polished terrazzo swallowed each footstep, The architects had designed the place so Whispers felt indicted. He arrived early, habit masquerading as professionalism, but deputy directors and section chiefs already ringed the oval table like vultures. Their murmurs died the moment he walked in. He took the presenter's seat at the hollow surface. Director Markovich entered seconds later, no tie, gray shirt sleeves cuffed once, the ever-ready field officer look. Serbian by birth, American by naturalization, he carried Balkan ceasefires in the lines around his eyes and, for reasons Samuel never fully understood, had fast-tracked a small-town tinkerer into the agency's top analyst tier. "Mr. Hollis," Markovich said, sliding into his chair, "let's begin." The lights dimmed. Topographic hollow tiles floated above the table like layered playing cards. Samuel steadied his breathing. "The consortium we're tracking," he began, "uses defunct textile importers as fronts. Three shipments of gate-encoded exoskeleton actuators left Rijeka in the last quarter. All roads lead to two warehouses in Belgrade." A deputy interrupted, voice raw with cheap coffee. "Prototypes or salvage?" "Prototypes," Samuel answered. "Cobalt alloy joints, servo-torque 5x NATO spec. A private auction is scheduled in 8 days. "Hosted where?" another asked. "Location undisclosed. Agent Eliza Koliva is on site to confirm." Static rippled through the room. Even the air handlers seemed to hold their breath. Markovich leaned forward. "Speak, status on Agent Koliva?" Samuel's tongue felt sanded. "Last transmission, 2200 hours GMT. No burst ping since." A woman from Signals spoke up, barely above a whisper. "She never misses a window." "Correct," Samuel said, and let the implication hang. Markovich's jaw flexed. "Initiate a SIGINT sweep. Field response?" Silence collected like dust. Every eye turned to Samuel. He tasted battery acid on the back of his throat. "I'm an analyst," he managed. "Yes," Markovich said evenly. "An analyst who speaks their code, knows their hardware, and understands the city. I need you in Belgrade, Mr. Hollis, yesterday." The walls shrank. Then Eliza's last voicemail surfaced in his mind, her coastal Bulgarian lilt teasing him for refusing plum brandy. She had stomped out his self-doubt like a cigarette. He swallowed. "Understood." Dismissed, Samuel slipped into the corridor and let the adrenaline drain. A disused file room offered breathing space. Shelves stacked with dust-filmed towers, the fluorescence stuttering like a failing marquee. He dropped onto a metal stool, opened Eliza's data pack, and watched strings of compression code unspool. Buried among checksum errors, he found coordinates: 44823, 2450, Kalemegdan Park, the fortress that crowns Belgrade's old city. A message for him alone. He closed his eyes and made a silent promise. Memory yanked him 3 years back. He's on a mock street grid at Fort Meade, weapons sling loose, lungs burning. He has just muffed a pursuit drill. Took a corner too wide, lost the suspect. Eliza jogs back, not even winded. "That was elegant," she teases, shades hiding the spark in her eyes. "Elegant failure is still failure," he pants. She flicks his forehead. "Fear is data statistic. Train your body to read it at speed, then rewrite the code." She jogs off, calling over her shoulder. "And eat something green. Red Bull's not a vegetable." Warmth and humiliation, inseparable, fade with the memory. A knock pulled him to the present. Director Markovich stepped in, closing the door behind him. For a beat, he studied the relic electronics, nostalgia softening the steel in his gaze. "When I arrived," he said, "these rigs were state-of-the-art. Now they're epitaphs." Samuel straightened. "You want me in Serbia? I want Eliza back and those prototypes off the market." "You mentioned limited support. Balkan office can spare a driver and a safe house for 72 hours. After that, Brussels calls dibs. No cavalry, just surgical work." He handed over a slim folder. "Travel as Henry S. Walsh, robotics consultant. One-way commercial. Open return." He paused. "Bring her home, Hollis. She believed you could." "Did she say that?" "Not in words." The director's hand settled on his shoulder, weight equal parts order and benediction. "She chose her partners." The folder felt heavier than paper had any right to. By nightfall, Samuel packed a single carry-on. Two dress shirts, a field jacket, universal screwdrivers, and the scar-polished Swiss Army knife his father had pressed into his palm the day he left Schiller Falls. He stitched Eliza's microdrive into a hidden seam.
Advisors pleaded with him to remain in sheltered government offices, yet he would emerge at midnight, black Homburg hat tilted, to feel the city's pulse firsthand. Some visits lasted only a quarter hour, a handshake here, a word there, yet survivors remembered them for decades. A woman from Bethnal Green later recalled, "He looked at the ruins and then at us, and I feared he might cry. Instead, he set his jaw, and I thought, well, if he can stand it, so can I." Modern neuroscience would call this emotional contagion the mirroring circuitry that sinks human nervous systems. Churchill felt it instinctively. His presence in bomb sites was no mere photo opportunity. It was an act of co-regulation, lowering the community's cortisol by first regulating his own. He fortified that inner stillness through deliberate ritual, dictating letters in the bath, taking strategic naps, and even painting landscapes during lulls, all techniques to reset the mind before the next onslaught of sirens. Now tilt your ear toward the wireless set in a cramped basement shelter. A family huddles under blankets, teacups rattling with each nearby explosion. The radio crackles, and Churchill's voice pours out, husky, measured, intimate, despite the static. He admits the hardships plainly, never sparing unpleasant truths, but frames every fact inside a larger arc of endurance. Listeners lean closer, the children stop fidgeting, and for a few minutes the war shrinks from a cosmic terror to a storyline in which they, too, hold a part. Of course, steadiness does not imply absence of doubt. In a private note dated after a particularly brutal raid, Churchill scribbled, "Are we strong enough?" Yet he folded that page, placed it in his pocket, and walked into a war cabinet meeting projecting iron certainty. The duality mattered, vulnerability acknowledged in private so that confidence might be offered in public. His colleagues left the room feeling taller. The nation, in turn, sensed resolve. A single speech rarely changes a war, but a steady drumbeat of composure alters the psychology of millions. Insurance actuaries would later discover that civilian deaths during the Blitz were lower on nights following a Churchill broadcast. Fewer heart attacks, fewer panic-induced accidents. The correlation may be imperfect, yet it suggests what historians have long intuited. Emotional leadership shapes outcomes as surely as materiel. Pause with that thought, because the pattern will reappear far from bomb shelters. Picture, if you will, an altogether different setting. A sleek corporate boardroom in New Jersey, the calendar flipped to 1982. Fluorescent lights hum overhead, and telephones ring in an uneven staccato. The chair at the head of the table belongs to James Burke, CEO of Johnson & Johnson. Capsules of Tylenol, America's best-selling pain reliever, have been laced with cyanide. 7 people are dead. Panic churns nationwide. We will come to that boardroom soon enough. For now, hold the image in the periphery of your mind the way distant thunder hints at an approaching storm. Churchill's midnight walks and James Burke's looming decision belong to the same lineage. Both men will confront crises that strip away the trappings of office until only voice, presence, and values remain. Both will learn, or reveal, that steadiness is not a talent bestowed, but a discipline practiced. As London's sirens finally fade toward dawn, we leave the Prime Minister lighting a fresh cigar on the steps of 10 Downing Street. He has dictated an address for the afternoon, drained a tumbler of weak whiskey, and allowed himself a single sigh. The city lies scarred yet unbroken. Overhead, a pinkish glow suggests sunrise through drifting smoke. Somewhere across the Atlantic, a company quartered in quiet suburbia prepares for another ordinary decade, unaware that its own trial by fire will require a very Churchillian measure of calm. Turn the page, dear listener. The next alarm is about to ring. October 1982. The new alarm sounds not like an air raid siren, but like a telephone ringing at 6:30 a.m. in suburban Chicago. In a split-level house, a father lifts the receiver. A nurse on the line tells him his 12-year-old daughter Mary has arrived in the emergency room unresponsive. Moments earlier, she had complained of a cold and swallowed 1 extra-strength Tylenol. By 9:56 a.m., Mary Kellerman is pronounced dead, with the hospital left to file it under unexplained. 3 miles away, postal worker Adam Janice leaves work early with chest pain, pops 2 Tylenol capsules, and collapses on his kitchen floor. He dies at 3:15 p.m. In that same house, still raw with grief, Adam's brother and sister-in-law each take Tylenol from the same bottle. Within minutes, both are gasping for air. Paramedics return to a scene they left only hours before. By nightfall on September 29th, 7 otherwise healthy people in the Chicago area, ages 12 to 35, have died, all linked to a simple red and blue capsule laced with potassium cyanide. Someone, somewhere, has been placing tainted bottles back on store shelves. News reaches Johnson & Johnson headquarters in New Brunswick, New Jersey, just after dawn on September 30th. In a corner office, CEO James Burke sets down his coffee as an assistant relays the grim facts. 7 fatalities, all tied to extra-strength Tylenol lot MC-2880 and Chicagoans being told to toss their Tylenol. Reporters want comment. Burke's first act is deceptively small. He opens a desk drawer, pulls out the dog-eared 1943 credo, penned by Robert Wood Johnson, and reads aloud, "We believe our first responsibility is to doctors, nurses, and patients." Turning to his crisis team, he says, "Our course of action is on this card. We will do whatever is necessary to protect the people who use our products." By hour 16 of the crisis, that afternoon, while investigators swarm Chicago supermarkets, Burke steps before a bank of microphones. His posture is open, voice steady, yet sorrow-cracked. "Our hearts go out to the families," he begins. No hedging, no legalese. He announces an immediate regional recall of every Tylenol bottle matching the identified lots. The decision costs millions, but Burke doesn't waver.
No lucky coins. Superstition felt dishonest. The Vine Street studio he'd called home smelled of takeout curry and dying succulents. He realized how little there was to leave behind. Possessions are ballast. He had spent years preparing to lift off. An Uber idled at the curb, wipers fighting drizzle. The driver avoided eye contact, sensing the tension that rolled off Samuel like cold vapor. At the airport, he cleared security, heart hammering each time a scanner beeped. Flight 219 to Frankfurt, then on to Belgrade. Gate A17. Row 19, aisle seat. A pale woman with a navy cardigan took the window, earbuds already in. Samuel buckled his belt, knuckles whitening. Turbines spooled, cabin lights dimmed. He opened his tablet and let the blue pin of Calamegdan burn onto his retina. Outside, sodium lamps streaked the wet tarmac, saffron and gold. Cincinnati receded. The horizon ahead was a city he knew only from satellite passes. Samuel Hollis inhaled recycled cabin air, filling the hollow spaces, and prepared for a descent no analyst handbook could teach. The wheels kissed the tarmac at Nikola Tesla Airport with a curt squeal, the kind of welcome a wary city gives newcomers. Beyond the runway, low clouds snagged on sodium lamps, and the Sava River showed only as a darker stripe in the night. Samuel realized he was still crushing the armrest long after the jet slowed. He forced his fingers open and let recycled air scrape across his knuckles. Passport control moved with Balkan indifference, neither sluggish nor brisk, simply immune to anyone else's timetable. Samuel handed over the navy blue booklet that named him Henry Stephen Walsh of Chicago, robotics consultant. The officer, parsley caught between his teeth, flipped pages as though searching for gossip rather than visas, stamped without comment, and waved him on. Baggage claim smelled of reheated pastries and detergent. Suitcases paraded by in plastic wrap until Samuel's carry-on surfaced, scuffed but whole. Across the belt, a compact man in a threadbare blazer hoisted a cylindrical courier tube sealed with red security tape. The man's gaze skittered along exit doors and mirrored ceilings the way a boxer watches shoulders, not fists. Not airport nervous, street nervous. Samuel logged the detail, slung his bag, and flowed toward the taxis. Night air slapped him, diesel, river vapor, stale cigarettes. An engine backfired up the lane. The courier jolted, pivoted, and disappeared into a rust-red Yugo whose driver looked like he'd been poured into a leather jacket. Trunk slammed, tires barked, and the car slid into traffic. Analysts collate, they don't chase. He reminded himself twice, and Eliza's half-smile, lip caught between her teeth while she wrestled code, reminded him a third time. Samuel pulled out his phone, snapped the Yugo's plate, KY153BG, and climbed into the first Mercedes in line. In careful Serbian, he told the driver, two cars behind the red Yugo. The driver, 50-ish, with a wrestler's neck, met his eyes in the mirror. "If trouble, you pay the dent." "I'll tip for avoidance," Samuel answered. A grunt, a gear shift, and they slid into the arterial flow. Belgrade unveiled itself in noir flickers. Gen X Towers' brutalist halo. Billboards for energy drinks spelled in Cyrillic. A neon cross crowning St. Sava's dome. Each red light felt like a breath the city begrudged them. Still the Yugo stayed ahead, taillights winking through tram wires and graffiti-lit underpasses. On Brankova, the car veered downhill toward Old Town. Graffiti dragons and anti-fascist slogans glowed violet under street lamps. Near Studentsky Trg, the Yugo lurched to the curb. The courier, Philip Samuel decided he would call him, hugged the tube and cut across the open plaza toward Kala Megdan, the fortress that had watched empires drown. Samuel paid the fare, slid out, and checked his watch. 2113. Stone sentries, Ottoman cannon, Austrian bastions, framed the park entrance. The courier zigzagged for shadowed walkways. Contraband prefers shade. Halfway up the path, Samuel's SATCOM locked for emergencies, pulsed once. Eliza's encrypted signature. No coordinates. Gone again. His mouth went dry. Ahead, the courier vanished behind a bastion arch. He lengthened his stride. A motorcycle shrieked to a stop inches from his hip, front wheel blocking the path. The rider cut the engine and lifted his visor. "Tourists choose the lit path," the man said in English, roughened by Belgrade streets. Early 30s, dark curls plastered to his forehead, storm blue eyes that measured Samuel like a locksmith sizing pins. A checkmate Zastava hung at his hip, strap unsnapped. "Lost my map," Samuel offered. The rider's glance flicked uphill. "You're tailing Philip the postman, bad hobby." Samuel felt the question grow teeth. "Trust no one, or die cautious? He's carrying something I need." "You and half the rats here." The man kicked the bike alive. "Hop on, or keep jogging until someone less polite kneecaps you." Samuel swung aboard, gripping the metal rack instead of the stranger's jacket. Gravel spat from the rear tire as they climbed switchbacks under lime trees. When they braked beside a half-crumbled parapet, the rider thumbed his visor up. "I'm Luca," he said, stripping off the helmet. Sweat darkened the collar of a canvas field coat. "Former army engineer, current freelance idiot, you?" "Samuel Hollis," he answered before the alias could assemble. Luca's eyebrows rose, not at the name but at the truthfulness of it. "All right, Hollis, if you want what Philip's selling, you need a local who knows shortcuts and exit wounds. Philip works for Katerina Vukovic." The syllables chilled Samuel more than the wind off the river. "Venture capital darling, robotics prodigy." "And smuggler's wet dream," Luca added. "Come on, rats are already chewing." They stashed the bike behind brush and crept through a low arch that smelled of rusted cannon and damp centuries. Ahead, floodlights threw half-hearted halos over a courtyard. Philip knelt beside a steel crate while a tall lookout scanned the dark. A faint mosquito whine drifted closer. Luca's shoulders tightened. Drone. Specks flashed through Samuel's mind, thermal cameras, gate recognition, microcharges. He followed Luca behind a pockmarked statue just as a cone of LED light swept the courtyard.
"We will cooperate fully with authorities," he pledges, "and we urge the public not to consume any Tylenol until further notice." Inside the company, managers hold hourly briefings. Some propose continuing sales in unaffected states to cushion the financial blow. Burke shakes his head. "If we're debating saving dollars while people fear for their lives, we've lost our soul." The credo card lies on the conference table. By hour 36, the next morning, radio DJs across the nation are deluged with frantic callers. Pharmacists pull Tylenol from shelves even beyond Illinois. At 9 a.m., Burke authorizes a toll-free hotline staffed by nurses, not marketers. Calls spike to 2,000 per hour. Each caller hears an apology first, instructions second. Meanwhile, J&J mailrooms become makeshift grief counseling centers, with employees gently guiding letters from victims' families to corporate chaplains. By hour 48, FDA officials arrive in Burke's office clutching lab reports. Some capsules hold enough cyanide to kill 10 adults. Statistically, contamination might be contained to the Chicago area. The accountants argue for mitigating losses by recalling only specific lots. Burke eyes the credo on his desk and imagines a mother in Phoenix trusting Tylenol that very day. "We're pulling it all," he says. 31 million bottles, every strength, every lot, every state. Estimated loss, more than $100 million, half Tylenol's annual revenue. The board votes unanimously, some executives later admitting they did so only because Burke's resolve left no moral middle ground. 72 hours later, Sunday papers blare the headline, J&J orders nationwide recall. Burke holds a televised press conference in the company lobby so rank-and-file employees can watch from the stairwells above, a gesture of transparency. He outlines the logistics. Stores will receive shipping boxes and prepaid FedEx labels. Consumers can return open bottles for full refunds. No one in 1982 has attempted a product recall this massive, and Burke freely admits it. We are learning in real time, and we will keep you informed every step of the way. Reporters demand to know why J&J didn't have tamper-proof packaging. Burke refuses to be defensive. We didn't cause this crime, he says, but we accept responsibility for our product in the marketplace. Behind the scenes, he pushes engineers to design triple-seal, foil-wrapped, shrink-protected bottles in days instead of months. Make it visible, he tells them, so a grandmother with bad eyesight can spot tampering. 10 days in, October 11, Burke appears on daytime talk shows, methodically addressing the same questions without a trace of irritation. Viewers say his calm helps them feel safe to buy Tylenol again someday, though not yet. Meanwhile, FBI sketches of a hooded suspect circulate, but the killer remains at large. Rather than amplify the horror, Burke funds a public service campaign on tamper awareness, featuring hospitals, police chiefs, and consumer advocates, neutral voices more trusted than corporate spokespeople. Sales remain near paralysis, but the public mood shifts. People note J&J's candor. 40 days after the first alarm, by early November, warehouse workers in white gloves load pallets of Tylenol bearing bright red caps stamped new, safer, triple sealed. There is no grand relaunch event. Instead, Burke offers these bottles free to every hospital in America, betting that if nurses trust the product, patients will follow. Within 6 months, Tylenol regains a 33% market share, nearly its pre-crisis level. Competitors rush to mimic the packaging. Congress passes the 1983 Federal Anti-Tampering Act, which changes every pharmacy aisle in the country, and Burke keeps the credo card on his desk until retirement, its edges curled like a beloved photograph. And so, in the quiet aftermath, what do we pocket from those nerve-jangled weeks in 1982? First, empathy cannot be outsourced. Burke named the pain himself, ensuring every follow-up action rang true. Second, decisive transparency cuts off rumor at the root. Johnson & Johnson became the voice of first report, echoing Churchill's principle of frank, frequent updates. Third, values declared in peacetime serve as a compass in chaos. Burke did not invent altruism on September 30. He simply dusted off a 39-year-old promise. Lastly, bold measures age better than half measures. Recalling 31 million bottles looked reckless to some observers, yet history reveres the move for restoring trust. Similar crises still erupt. Food contamination, data hacks, and each time a leader stands at that same moral crossroads. Some hesitate, others, credo in hand, steady us all. Now we reset the clock to June 1944, where a very different commander faces an equally urgent decision. Yet the lesson of putting people first and truth fast remains vital, no matter the battlefield. Turn toward the coast of England. Another clock is ticking. Coastal England, 400 hours. June 5, 1944. The sky is a restless gray, neither night nor morning, thick with a wind that rattles tent flaps and scatters cigarette ash across maps already smudged by 100 anxious thumbs. Inside a makeshift operations hut at Southwick House, the Supreme Commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force leans over a table lit by a single swinging bulb. Dwight David Eisenhower, Ike, to everyone from presidents to privates, has removed his cap, rubbed the ridge above his brow, and asked the room for silence, except for the meteorologists. "I'm afraid the news is not very good," says Group Captain James Stagg, the dour Scot in charge of weather forecasts. Yesterday he called off the invasion because of gale-force winds. Now he points at a charcoal smear of isobars marching across the channel, then circles a tiny gap, indicating a possible 24-hour lull beginning in the early hours of the 6th. Seas will be rough, but manageable, the cloud ceiling high enough for bombers, winds dropping just enough for landing craft to hold a straight line. The next similar tide and moon combination will not arrive for nearly 3 weeks. By then, German defenses will be thicker and the secret of the planned landing sites could leak. Eisenhower listens, rocking gently on his heels, letting Stagg finish every clause.
The drone paused on the crate, then slid sideways, hunting. The beam clipped their column. A chirp, biometric lock, rotors pitched higher. "Run," Luca hissed. Gunfire cracked behind them. They dived through a collapsing doorway into a corridor reeking of mold. The drone pivoted, LEDs flipping to infrared. Samuel felt its electronic stare rake his spine. A spiral stair yawned downward. They clattered into medieval dark, phone torch bobbing. The drone couldn't spiral with them, but its rotors whirred along a parallel shaft, looking for another throat. They burst into an old powder room stacked with empty barrels. Luca slammed the oak door. "Won't hold," he panted. "Thermite charges." Samuel scanned the ceiling. Ventilation grills, narrow but reachable. If it can't see, it can't target. Luca hauled a barrel under the vent, multi-tool already working screws. Outside, sirens wailed, police or private militia dressed like them. The last screw fell. Cold air knifed in. A glassy camera nose dipped through the gap. Samuel seized it, smashing the lens against stone. Luca wedged a bayonet into the housing. Sparks spat, rotors screamed, and the machine died half inside the duct. They dragged the carcass down, crashed off the barrel, and sprawled amid splintered props. Luca pried out a glossy black wafer, memory core, still hot. "Evidence, beacon," Samuel countered. "Then we leave." The wafer disappeared into a battered aluminum cigarette tin. They shoved through a side door into a dripping tunnel. Footsteps echoed ahead. The lookout, courier tube rattling in his grip. Luca plucked a chunk of masonry, hurled it. Metal rang, the man spun and fired blind. Muzzle flash strobed. Luca slammed an elbow into the shooter's throat. The pistol clattered away, skidding into darkness. The courier tube rolled to Samuel's feet, seal intact. He hesitated. "Take it," Luca said, rubbing his forearm. "Move." The tunnel spat them onto the lower ramparts. Below, the Danube glistened like split obsidian, Novi Beograd's towers blinking on the far bank. Spotlights began combing the walls behind them, amplified commands barking in Serbian. Private muscle, not state police. They half slid, half ran down gravel until warehouses crouched at the water's edge. Samuel snagged a root and stumbled. Luca hauled him upright. "Ground here eats men who look elsewhere," Luca muttered. A corrugated door hung crooked in the nearest warehouse. Inside, rope coils, motor oil, the faint salt of yesterday's river water. Moonlight striped the floor. Pigeons rustled but stayed. Samuel set the battered drone and courier tube on a crate. Luca looped a rusted chain through the latch. Silence pressed in, broken only by the tick of cooling circuitry. "We're alive," Samuel breathed. "Temporarily," Luca replied, a grin tugging. "You handled that lens like a machinist's son." Samuel exhaled a shaky laugh. "I had a good teacher." For a moment, they simply listened, to their hearts, to the city hunting outside, to the river pushing east. The memory wafer still radiated heat in Luca's pocket. And somewhere beyond the fort's shadow, a woman who never missed a check-in was waiting to be found. Moonlight slanted through broken panes when Luca's phone pulsed. Two muffled chirps, all bass and no melody. He checked the screen and hissed, "Contacts 5 minutes out. Name's Vieco. Punctuality and sunlight, he loathes both." Samuel studied the ruined drone on the crate, its gouged lens catching shards of starlight. "He can lift the data without tripping any dead man code?" "If he can't," Luca said, "we'll be tomorrow's clickbait." The warehouse door rasped open. A lank figure slipped under the lintel. Vieco looked barely 30, hair shaved close except for one stubborn crest that quivered like a tuning fork. Over an oversized hoodie he wore a municipal safety vest, perfect camouflage for someone who never wanted to be seen. No greeting, no handshake. "Show me the patient," he said in rapid Serbian. Luca translated more for Samuel's benefit than Vieco's. Using tweezers, Samuel set the wafer in Vieco's felt-lined kit. A visor dropped over Vieco's eyes, glowing cyan. His thumbs flicked a glass pad. Strings of code rippled across the lenses. "Military onion shell, triple salt," he murmured. "Adorable." A hiss of coolant, a deft twist, click, less adorable. While he worked, Luca paced among the crates, restless in the sudden quiet. Samuel understood. Silence after gunfire felt like a held breath. "You're American," Vieco said, switching to lightly accented English. "Your keyboard spacing's all over the hash tables." "Leased to own American," Samuel answered. "What else do you see? Whoever owned this bird distrusts analog anything." One last keystroke and coordinates shimmered on his visor. He pinged them onto the peeling wall. 44.8219 degrees N, 20.4724 degrees E. Samuel recognized them before the decimals stopped scrolling. "Chukaritsa, old tram factory." "More than that," Vieco added. drone was live streaming biometric matches to a repeater on site. Your faces are already in the archive. So we torch the server, Luca said. Or we grab it before they back it up, Samuel countered, surprised at the conviction in his own voice. Vieco folded his kit. You'll need clean badges. City cameras choke that district. Best place to buy is the bazaar. Payment, safe ride there, and 10 minutes of uplink so I can fence the exploit. Luca's jaw twitched. That telltale grind between conscience and necessity. Deal, but first he, a nod at Samuel, needs the story. Later, Samuel started. Now, Luca insisted. Anna lost her legs in that factory. Training cadets on those same rigs, servo froze, battery flared. She shoved two kids clear before it blew. 18 surgeries, and the people who shipped the junk raised champagne with investors. The words came flat, but Samuel felt the force behind them. Then we shut it down, he said, or we bury it. Luca searched his face, found resolve, and turned to Vieco. Pack it! We move. They slipped onto the riverwalk shrouded in mist. Luca's Yamaha waited behind briars. Vieco unchained a dented e-scooter. Silent wheels for a silent man.
He grants expert space to disagree in front of him, not behind him. Only after the forecast wrap does he look around the table. Montgomery, Lee Mallory, Ramsey, Bedell Smith, Bradley. All men with conflicting priorities, all watching him. He speaks softly, almost conversationally. Well, gentlemen, I'm inclined to go. A pause. Some nod, some frown. Air Chief Marshal Lee Mallory warns that airborne casualties could reach 70% if the winds whip up again. Eisenhower thanks him, then repeats, a shade firmer. Let's go. The room exhales. Decision made at 4:15. In 12 hours, landing craft will begin forming convoys. At 23:30, the first paratroopers will board C-47s. Outside the hut, Ike buttons his coat against the chill and walks alone for a minute to hear the crunch of gravel under his boots, a sensory anchor he has used since his West Point days. After this brief solitary cadence to quiet his mind, he rejoins his staff and dictates the famous order. Overlord will proceed as planned. Accountability greets him before dawn fully breaks. Back in his caravan trailer, he takes out a small note card, flips it to the blank side, and writes by penciled lamplight. Our landings in the Cherbourg-Le Havre area have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold, and I have withdrawn the troops. My decision to attack at this time and place was based upon the best information available. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone. He folds the note and tucks it into his wallet. By imagining failure as a contained, signed document, Eisenhower frees his attention for the only influence still available, execution. Years later, he will discover that in his fatigue, he dated the note July 5th instead of June 5th. But the mission now moves from maps to men. Shortly after 900, he climbs into a green sedan and heads for Newbury, where the 101st Airborne is camped among apple orchards. Rows of C-47s sit wingtip to wingtip, their fuselages freshly painted with black and white invasion stripes. Paratroopers lounge on kit bags, writing last letters. Eisenhower could give a formal address. Instead, he wades among them, crouching so he's eye level with troopers seated on the grass, asking where they're from. Yakima, Washington, sir. He grins and recalls fishing there once, and laughter bubbles up. Cameras capture him with thumbs hooked into his belt, face creased, radiating a confidence so casual it feels borrowed from a Sunday picnic rather than the eve of the largest amphibious assault in history. By talking of fishing rods and baseball scores, he downshifts the emotional gear, reminding them they are still part of a normal world worth returning to. As departure time nears, he gathers a small circle for practical advice. If you see gunfire coming up, don't just stand there. Move a little to one side, then the other. It's half joke, half tactical tip, and it humanizes him. Veterans will recall that the Supreme Commander looked more anxious than they did. That paradox gives them courage. If the top man is worried yet still moving forward, so can they. Night draws its veil. In the channel, 5,000 vessels, destroyers, troop transports, LSTs, plow through combers. On every bridge, commanding officers read aloud Eisenhower's simple message, "You are about to embark upon the Great Crusade." Crafted two nights earlier over coffee, it contains no flamboyance, just short, declarative sentences. It arrives after the point of no return, when the only productive emotion is forward focus. Past midnight, Eisenhower returns to his trailer. He lies on a cot beneath photographs of Mamie and their terrier, then forces himself to read Western novels until sleep takes him for 2 hours. When he wakes, it is June 6th. By 400, radioed reports trickle in. Clouds are breaking, seas rough but passable. At 5:30, HMS Belfast opens fire on the Normandy shoreline, and the channel shakes with ordnance. Inside his command room, information is still patchy. German broadcasters claim paratroopers are drowning in flooded fields. Churchill wires for updates every 30 minutes. Roosevelt's emissary sits quietly in the corner with a notebook. Eisenhower paces slowly, hands clasped behind his back. A junior officer blurts that the operation seems pretty confused. Ike stops, places a hand on the man's shoulder, and says, "Before this day is over, confusion will be your closest companion. But remember, you are here because I trust you to think." It is empowerment in a single sentence. By 1,000 hours, updates improve. Utah Beach meets lighter resistance than feared. Omaha is bloody but gaining a foothold. Gold, Juno, and Sword vary, yet progress. Eisenhower allows a small smile, telephones Washington, and speaks with a voice level and unhurried. "So far, so good." He offers no grand claims, just enough detail to preempt rumor and sustain attentiveness. And what of the failure note in his wallet? By nightfall, he realizes he will not need to release it. The mere fact of its existence has served its purpose. He admitted the possibility of defeat privately, shouldering blame so his subordinates could act without fear of post-battle scapegoating. As darkness returns to Normandy, dotted now with Allied campfires, Eisenhower drafts a communique praising the day's courage while framing it as a first step. "The road ahead will be long and hard," he writes, bracing the troops for what lies beyond the beaches. "Let us step back from the map table and examine the pattern emerging from these hours." Eisenhower cultivates a circle of candid debate but decides swiftly, separating deliberation from execution. He pre-writes acceptance of blame to inoculate against hindsight bias. He resets his nervous system through quick, deliberate breaks, solitary movement on gravel, light banter with men, and brief sleep. He communicates in measured pulses, enough to inform, never so much as to overload or grandstand. Finally, he commits visible acts of presence, saluting planes and visiting assembly areas, to convey steadiness more powerfully than any memo. Modern research on decision latency shows that performance deteriorates after too little deliberation, but also after too much. Eisenhower's call at 415 is the optimal midpoint.
The three of them threaded south past 24-hour kiosks and pensioners blitzing chessboards at 2 a.m. The bazaar announced itself by heat alone, server exhaust rising through a steel hatch. Luca rapped a syncopated code, locks unbolted, neon side upward. Below, salvage racks glowed like stained glass servers. Vendors lounged on plastic thrones, fingers flicking AR menus only they could see. Every breath tasted of ozone and cardamom. A stall built from welded shopping carts displayed identity stacks like pirated DVDs. The proprietor, a woman with silver studs marching up her cheekbones, regarded them with bored sovereignty. Luca introduced her, Myrna, Exporter Police Biometrics, now selling one-way doors to anyone armed with cash or grievance. Myrna slid Philip's courier tube into an opaque scanner. Digits wheeled across her iris. Foreman badges, discontinued 2014. Chukuritsa still uses the old readers. 50,000 dinar or one comparable sin. Vieco lifted a brow. Half, plus first crack at the flight path data. She weighed the offer, then nodded. Two slim cards clacked onto the counter. She tossed Samuel a demagnetizer, obsolete, reassuringly heavy. "Scrub the stripe once you're past the gate." A hush rippled through the aisle. Myrna's eyes flicked over Samuel's shoulder. Showtime. Static snow spiraled above a central dais, hardening into the hologram of Dr. Katerina Vukovic. Even in flicker, she radiated command. Charcoal suit, silver Mobius lapel pin, chin lifted as if gravity were negotiable. "The courier is compromised," the hollow said, voice velvet over steel. "Replacement package arrives at dawn. Double rates for safe passage, triple for silence. Recover the lost memory core," her gaze locked on Samuel, "and you'll be paid in untraceable equity and absolution." The image collapsed. The market erupted. Luca hauled Samuel toward a maintenance tunnel. "She's crowdsourcing your head," Samuel's pulse thudded. If the enemy wants the evidence, either keep it or smash it. Both sound safer, Luca answered. Nearby, Vieco hammered an idle console, slicing the exploit into 7 encrypted packets. Clock's red, he called. Payment cleared. Transport clause, please. They emerged onto a street bruised with pre-dawn blue. Bakeries fired ovens, trams squealed awake. Luca strapped a second helmet on Samuel and tossed a third toward Vieco. I vanish better on foot, Vieco declined, pocketing the demagnetizer Samuel pressed into his hand. Americans tip with favors, I'll remember. Then he was gone, swallowed by Belgrade's low-voltage sprawl. Luca kicked the Yamaha alive. The engine rumbled like distant artillery. They arrowed east, sodium lamps giving way to gray-gold light. Cranes lined the horizon, gulls scavenged in their shadows. Air smelled of concrete dust and river clay. Samuel thumbed the embossed tram logo on the forged badge. Chukaritsa's sawtooth roofs loomed ahead, blotting the newborn sun. He leaned toward Luca's ear. For Anna. Luca didn't speak, but he raised 2 fingers to the sky. Salute. Promise. Threat. The bike surged, carrying them toward the factory where steel once sang and faith in machines first cracked. The sun barely cleared the factory roofline, a weak coin that offered light but no warmth. From the ridge above Chukaritsa, the abandoned tram works looked like a whale skeleton rolled onto its side. Iron ribs jutting, glass long since knocked out by wind and teenagers with bricks. Luca cut the Yamaha's engine 2 blocks short and let the bike coast, chain ticking, until silence thickened around them. Foreman entrance is east, he murmured. Less glass, fewer YouTube booby traps. Samuel thumbed the forged badge in his pocket. Paper-thin laminate, purpose-thick courage. Hard or soft? Soft. Hard finds us soon enough. They vaulted a sagging fence, boots squelching where last night's rain had pooled among syringe caps and broken bottles. Inside, the main hall gaped like a cathedral. No prayer could save. Safety posters hung in rags, a cartoon worker praising lockout procedures, half his grin scorched away. Samuel took a heartbeat to map the space. Exits, catwalk lattice, the rust-fringed pit where trams once sat. Above, something clicked and scraped. Not pigeons. Metal legs. 4 spider drones patrolled the I-beams, rolling on magnetic wheels. 6 servo limbs each, domed heads swiveling, photoreceptors blinking red Morse. Luca froze, breath corked. Infrared sweep every 8 seconds, Samuel whispered. They use reflections for depth. Luca tilted his chin at a heap of cracked safety helmets. Mirrors, then. They each grabbed one, angling the dull plastic outward. When the nearest drone scanned, its beam scattered, finding nothing human at chest height. Step by slow step, they advanced, moving in the blind spots like chess pieces in a thunderstorm. Mid-floor, a boot scuff and a voice smooth as varnish. Drop the toys, gentlemen. Katerina's lieutenant emerged from behind a derelict compressor, pistol held with a smoker's ease. Tall, pressed slacks, oxblood wingtips that had never tasted factory grime. The name tag read Tomashevich, though nothing about him suggested blue-collar origins. Samuel lifted empty hands. Luca's helmet clattered to the floor, spinning before it settled. Tomashevich nodded toward a maintenance bay. Walk. They obeyed. Floodlights inside revealed 3 prisoners zip-tied to scaffold braces. One wore an oil-stained lab coat over a Chicago Bulls t-shirt, salt and pepper beard, wire-rim glasses. The engineer Jasper Morales, if Samuel's dossier memory served. Tomashevich planted himself between them and the door. Dr. Vukovic expected scavengers. You, American, were the easiest to predict. Your dossier reads like a tract on predictable mistakes. He tapped his earpiece. Target acquired. Beside Samuel, Luca tensed, a violin string ready to snap. The comm click summoned the spiders. Drones skittered overhead, magnets hissing. Samuel's mind inventoried. Helmet plastic, aluminum scaffold, Swiss knife, 2 lithium drill batteries orphaned on a bench. Enough for a kindergarten science fair, or a pocket EMP. Keep talking, Samuel told the lieutenant. Tomashevich frowned. Pleading already? Hardly.
He waited long enough for marginally improved data, yet not so long that momentum evaporated. The principle applies widely. In surgery, finance, any field where windows of opportunity appear and vanish. Timing is part art, part discipline, and once the brush meets the canvas, the artist must trust the stroke. By week's end, Paris newspapers secretly printed in London headline, Force of Eisenhower's Will Breaks Hitler's Wall. In private, Eisenhower credits meteorologists, sailors, riflemen. Accountability flows upward, credit flows downward. Nearly 80 years later, leadership seminars still feature the photograph of Ike among paratroopers, grin alive, thumbs in his belt. Students parse it for clues about charisma, yet the deeper lesson was scaffolded by careful habits, pacing alone on gravel to calm his nerves, penciling a note that pre-absorbed blame, joking with men so they recalled home, sleeping just enough to keep his focus, then communicating facts plainly as events unfolded. As waves slap Normandy breakwaters and the first wounded reach hospital ships, we slip forward in time. A tall lawyer in a prison courtyard will one day practice many of these same disciplines, walking alone, rehearsing magnanimity, drafting letters he hopes never to mail. Before we stand beside Nelson Mandela, we linger on Eisenhower's legacy. Leadership is a tempo. Hold it steady in armies, corporations, nations, everyone searching for a pulse to follow, will move with your beat. The tide recedes, but the rhythm he set keeps rolling. The gravel road outside Victor Verster Prison is already vibrating when dawn lifts its pale shoulder over the Cape Winelands on the 11th of February 1990. Vendors sell ANC flags still stiff from fresh dye, police helicopters rotor overhead, teenagers chant freedom songs that rise and break like surf against the limestone walls. Somewhere inside those walls, a 71-year-old lawyer ties his shoelaces with deliberate calm, exactly as he has done every morning for 27 years. Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela steps through the gate at 3:59 p.m., hand in hand with Winnie, and the crowd's roar seems capable of toppling mountains. For a heartbeat, the noise is pure, ecstatic thunder, then it threatens to tilt into frenzy. Stones have already flown at a line of riot police. Reporters feel the shiver of potential stampede. Mandela pauses. He lifts the clenched fist salute the world expects, but only halfway, then opens his fingers into a gentle wave. The gesture is microscopic compared with the banners and bullhorns, yet its meaning travels instantly. Power, yes, but also restraint. The chanting modulates. People exhale. A nation teetering between jubilation and riot gains a few precious inches of emotional ground. That wave was not improvised. Fellow inmates recall Mandela pacing the prison courtyard practicing three versions of his release salute, high, middle, low. The middle one won because it signaled resolve without triumphalism. He understood, as Churchill once did in bomb craters and Eisenhower did on gravel paths, that crowds borrow the heartbeat they are shown. Mandela's heartbeat had been trained in harsher laboratories.
I just like to know who'll miss me. It was bait. Tomasevich closed the gap, fist knotted in Samuel's lapel. Luca pivoted, smashing an elbow into the gun arm, but the lieutenant rolled with the hit and fired. The shot grazed Luca's bicep. Crimson blossomed through the sleeve. Gunfire jolted the drones into kill mode. Servo legs unfolded, tungsten flechettes pinged off concrete. Samuel dived behind a milling machine, gutting the drill batteries. Wire, insulation, capacitor, improvised coil. Low radius, maybe 15 feet, but that was the whole room. Across the bay, Luca squeezed off three rounds, pinning the lieutenant behind a crate. Morales shouted, "I'm Jasper Morales, GE Avionics. Could we die later, please?" "When was your last tetanus shot?" Luca growled, knotting a tourniquet. 2 years. "Great, sparks incoming." Samuel bridged the battery leads with a screwdriver. Electricity shuddered. 10 seconds. He met Luca's eyes, nod given, and rolled the crackling bundle under the nearest drone cluster. Flash, sound swallowed by white noise, hearing stuffed with cotton. A wall of ionized air blanked every LED. Spiders froze mid-scuttle and crashed like gutted chandeliers. Tomasevich's pistol clicked uselessly. Its smart optic board had fried. Ears ringing, Samuel vaulted forward, shoulder-checking the stunned lieutenant and stripping the weapon. Luca slashed zip ties, freeing Morales and the two younger techs. Overhead, a conduit blew, sparks raining into solvent puddles. Flames licked asbestos paint, belching black smoke. "Out," Luca barked. They herded the techs toward a loading ramp. Behind them, Tomasevich clawed for a backup pistol, then crashed hip-deep as rotten flooring surrendered. "Not worth ceremony," Samuel ran. The corridor filled with smoke hot as printer exhaust. Skylights exploded. Daylight speared through dust like interrogation lamps. Morales stumbled. Samuel steadied him. Outside, raw sun baked the yard. Luca corralled everyone behind overturned cable spools. A long-dead fire alarm found a final pulse, wailing like a ghost, desperate for work. Morales coughed, bent double. 6 months on Katerina's payroll. Thought we were building rehab rigs. She switched to military buyers. Samuel handed him water. Why keep you alive? She needed firmware patches and my signature for tonight's demonstration. Demonstration, Luca pressed. The auction. Moved up. Floating data center. A barge with servers and a drone hangar. Launches at sunset, moors mid-Danube for 3 hours, then slips into international waters. Pressure clamped Samuel's chest. Eliza Kaleva? Morales's gaze sharpened. She walked in yesterday, posing as buyer liaison. Said she'd sabotage from inside. Told me to keep quiet. I doubt she planned on drones tagging your face. Luca spat iron-flavored saliva. She's volunteering to drown with the barge. Unless we pull her first, Samuel said, surprised by the steel in his own voice. Morales straightened. Get me to a terminal with line of sight to the barge's uplink mast, and I can seed an override. Otherwise, may God invoice your bravery. Sirens rose, state emergency crews, or Katerina's masquerading muscle.
On Robin Island, he would wake before the guards, make his bed with military corners, and recite Invictus under his breath until his pulse slowed. He learned Afrikaans so he could debate warders in their own tongue, not to flatter them, but to enter the emotional logic of the people who might one day share a ballot box with him. Emotional regulation, language study, bed corners, each a brick in an unseen foundation that made the public wave possible. Cape Town City Hall, 2 hours after his release. The square seethes with 100,000 people, many brandishing stones for want of placards. Mandela's first free speech in a generation lasts all of 7 minutes. He thanks international allies, honors the fallen, then delivers the line his closest advisors fretted over. Tonight I stand here before you, not as a prophet, but as a humble servant of you, the people. Servant, not avenger. The word choice lands like cool rain on tin roofs. A reporter later wrote, "The rocks went back into pockets when he said that." Yet rhetoric alone does not keep rifles quiet. Over the next 4 years, South Africa will lose more lives to political violence than during the entire prison era. Each spike of bloodshed tests Mandela's capacity to transmute anger. The most perilous spike arrives Easter weekend, 1993, when assassins gun down Chris Hani, a hugely popular ANC military leader. Township streets ignite, white suburbs barricade themselves, intelligence cables whisper that civil war is hours away. President de Klerk addresses the nation first, but his words skim the surface like stones. At 7:34 p.m., SABC studios cut to Mandela. Gray hair, charcoal suit, eyes red from weeping, voice steeled. He does not begin with condemnation. He begins with identification. "Tonight, an unforgivable crime has torn the heart of our nation," he says, leaning toward the camera as though toward a hospital bed. Then, crucially, he places white and black South Africans on the same side of the moral ledger. We are a people bound together by the pain of this loss. The pronoun we enlarges the circle. Only after weaving that emotional fabric does he name the danger. Retaliation. We must not allow racists to derail the march to freedom. Viewers describe feeling shoulders unclench. In the 72 hours following the broadcast, violence does not vanish, but the avalanche everyone feared never starts. Behind the camera, Mandela had followed a ritual Eisenhower would recognize. He asked for 5 minutes alone, walked a slow oval in the studio corridor, inhaled 4 counts, exhaled 4 counts, and silently rehearsed the first and last sentences of his address, anchors in the chaos. Only then did he step beneath the hot lights. Negotiations with de Klerk, codenamed Kodsa, unfold in windowless rooms thick with cigarette smoke and side-eye suspicion. Mandela often arrives early, removes his jacket, and disarming gesture, pours coffee for the man who once signed his indefinite prison order. When tempers flare, he writes a single word on his yellow pad, "Listen," then folds his hands until the room quiets. He is not always serene. Aides recall eruptions of righteous anger.
"Speak," Samuel met Luca's eyes. Blood seeped, but the tourniquet held. Resolve burned brighter. "We split," Samuel decided. "You take Morales and the Tex. Find Vieco. Gear up. I head up river. Scout the barge. Locate Eliza." "Solo hero work is for cinema," Luca snapped. "You'll die. Numbers get noticed. Besides," Samuel said, offering the lieutenant's pistol grip first, "I'm not planning to die empty-handed." Luca took the gun, tucked it inside his jacket. 2 hours. Batenhalle docks. Miss it, and I burn the river myself." "Understood." They clasped forearms. Simple. iron. Luca shepherded the civilians toward a graffiti-scarred van whose keys still dangled miraculously from the ignition. Samuel jogged the opposite way, smoke roiling behind him, factory bones crackling to ruin. Each stride felt like turning pages yet unwritten, but the plot, rescue, reckoning, maybe redemption, was now etched hot in his blood. At the corner, he paused. Far downstream, sunlight flashed off cranes and antennae stitched to a low, dark hull. A floating data center already humming. Samuel Hollis squared his shoulders against the stink of burning wires and set off at a measured run, a man who finally trusted his own momentum. Belgrade baked under a spiteful sun as Samuel slipped through the staff door of the Sava Centaur convention complex. The smoke and sweat of the morning's factory fire still clung to him. Half hidden by a hotel laundry shirt and a charcoal blazer he'd liberated from a gift shop mannequin. So long as he didn't raise both arms, the disguise held. Inside, the Tech Expo gala buzzed, soft jazz, venture capital patter, and the clink of glass on capped teeth. Guests in smart glasses walked past holographic booths that promised strength, speed, salvation. Most of the red profit graphs hovering in their view were invisible to Samuel. He didn't need augmented reality to smell desperation. Myrna's badge cleared the first scanner. H.S. Walsh, Senior VC, Elemental Capital, and Samuel exhaled. He headed for the mezzanine above the keynote stage. Morales had marked it as the only public line of sight to the optic uplink feeding Katarina's auction barge. A hostess with asymmetric bangs intercepted him. "Investor track is left, sir." "My partner's giving the keynote," he said, flashing an anything for the boardroom grin. "I'm contractually obliged to clap." The smile bought passage. He drifted through a tide of too tight suits until Werner Draxler blocked the stairs. Ex-KSK commando turned security chief, shoulders wider than most doorframes. "Elemental Capital flies coach on wardrobe?" Draxler rumbled, eyes crawling from Samuel's badge to his shoes. "High fashion doesn't scale," Samuel deadpanned. "Margins are sexier." The slab of a face twitched, amusement or gas. "Dr. Vukovic prefers investors downstairs." "She'll prefer my discretion upstairs." Samuel stepped. Draxler's hand clamped his chest. "You were at the tram works." For one weightless second, Samuel considered denying, running, shooting, fainting. He settled on a shrug. "Had to kick the tires before I bankrolled the ride." The half-answer bought just enough doubt.
The difference is that the anger is directed at principles, never at the dignity of a person across the table. By separating policy combat from personal contempt, he keeps opponents present long enough to become partners. On the 27th of April, 1994, Election Day dawn reveals queues that snake across soccer fields and down dirt roads, citizens wrapped in blankets against the chill. In KwaZulu-Natal, Inkatha loyalists brandish machetes, vowing to sabotage polling stations. Mandela boards a helicopter, lands unannounced in a township riven by factional murders, and strides straight to the waiting line. He greets an Inkatha elder first, grasping the man's forearm in the traditional Zulu clasp, then an ANC youth still bandaged from recent clashes. The cameras catch the image, rivals sharing proximity without violence. Votes proceed. By sunset, even skeptics admit the country has crossed an invisible bridge. The inauguration on the 10th of May 1994 could have been a coronation of victors. Mandela rewrites the seating chart so that prison warder Christo Brand sits near Archbishop Tutu, and Chief Justice Michael Corbett, an Afrikaner who once upheld apartheid statutes, administers the oath. As thunderous flyovers fade, Mandela turns not to jubilant black townships, but to the military band in khaki uniforms. "Let us build together," he says. And the soldiers, many of them conscripts who once guarded township checkpoints, raise their brass instruments in salute. Historians later pick this moment, not the ballot count, as the instant civil war became historically improbable. One more symbol remains, the 1995 Rugby World Cup final at Ellis Park. Rugby is the fortress sport of white Afrikaners. Its very emblem, the Springbok, was detested in black townships. Minutes before kickoff, Mandela pulls a green number 6 jersey over his shoulders. The stadium gasps, then chants, "Nelson! Nelson!" The final whistle crowns South Africa champions, but the larger victory is that millions watching on township televisions cheer alongside suburban families. Psychological alchemy in 90,000 seats. What then can we distill from these vignettes of restraint? First, forgiveness is not forgetfulness. It is the strategic release of retaliatory impulse to preserve collective futures. Mandela never denied the wounds of the past, yet he spoke of them as shared inheritance, not private debt. Second, inclusive language. Our, we fellow South Africans, works like Velcro for fractured identities, offering micro-affiliations that violence would sever. Third, emotional regulation is a muscle. Mandela exercised it through routine, rehearsal, and deliberate bodily cues, the half-raised fist, the folded hands, the controlled breath, each choice transmitting calm chemistry to volatile crowds. Underneath stands a harder truth. Composure does not guarantee harmony. It merely creates the breathing room in which harmony can be negotiated. When generals plotted coups and militants craved vengeance, those extra breaths mattered.
Draxler growled something about lawsuits and let him pass. Upstairs, the air smelled of citrus polish and intrigue. A lone tech tinkered with a waist-high server disguised by ferns, Katarina's uplink. Samuel palmed a flute of elderflower fizz, leaned over the planter, and clipped a fingernail-sized drive onto an exposed USB port. One blue blink, then stealth mode. "Throughput looks solid," he said, and moved to the balcony rail. Below, house lights dimmed. Katarina Vukovits stepped into a single spotlight, navy suit sharp as midnight glass. The hall fell silent. "Mobility is the oldest human story," she began, vowels pure Belgrade. "From crawling to crossing oceans, we rewrote geography." Behind her, an exoskeleton torso rose, servos mimicking her open hand. Phones lifted like votive candles. Samuel watched the server lights under the ferns, still green. Good. Now he just had to leave. Katarina wrapped the speech in revenue and mercy, then climbed the stairs toward the mezzanine, toward him. Too late to hide. "Mr. Hollis," she said. No surprise, no heat, just data. "Dr. Vukovic, an analyst with field deficiencies, yet here you stand." Her glance flicked to the planter, one LED blink out of rhythm. She filed it away. He kept his voice level. "You have an agency officer on your barge. Free her, and the river stays quiet." "She's offering her surrender," Katarina replied. "Information dies with its carrier. Consider the lesson." Samuel shook his head. "We've both overstayed." "Katarina." He spoke the name flat, final. "The Danube eats secrets." She didn't flinch, only murmured, "Werner." Draxler advanced behind smoked glass. Samuel vaulted the banister, landed in a forest of drone kiosks, and sprinted. A copper mesh handkerchief flicked into a demonstration swarm. Rotors snarled, crashed onto Draxler's shoulders. 10 stolen seconds. He barreled through a staff-only door, down 3 flights, into the loading dock. A forklift, left idling, toppled crates into the commando's path. Outside, furnace heat punched him. He flagged a cab as alarms erupted behind. "Betten Halle," he ordered. "No sightseeing." The driver gunned south. Samuel fingered the fresh microdrive in his pocket. Telemetry for Luca's EMP. A small, brutal success. Betten Halle's waterfront lay mostly deserted in late afternoon haze. Luca crouched on a kiosk roof, machete across his knees, bandaged arms stiff. "Punctual," Luca called, half smile, half test. Samuel climbed up, tossed him the drive. "Server handshake, deck schematics, everything." "While you drank spritzers," Luca said, pocketing the prize, "I hired a smuggler." He pointed to a battered diesel-electric tug in mid-channel. Captain Miku, pipe, weathered naval cap, saluted with languid authority. Morales, Vieco, and 2 young techs clattered up the ladder, duffel bag of coils and batteries in tow. Morales spoke first. "EMP's built. We fry every servo within 50 meters. We'll also need an exit," Samuel said. "Barge loses power, the river keeps moving." Miku's tug purred, ready. Luca unrolled the barge blueprint on an upturned barrel, finger-jabbing the aft quadrant. "Server core under helipad."
The day Mandela leaves office in 1999, he writes a note that echoes Eisenhower's unused failure message. "I did my best. The future belongs to new hands." Accountability tucked in his jacket, he walks out of the Union buildings as an elder statesman, not a monarch. Outside, jacaranda blossoms drift across the Capitol like unsolicited confetti, a quiet salute to the man who taught a furious nation to count to 10, then to 1, together. In our next chapter, the stage shifts from dusty township streets to the cold glow of computer screens, where a different kind of siege, digital, invisible, instantaneous, will test whether the disciplines of calm can scale into cyberspace. For now, hold the image of that half-raised fist softening into an open palm. It is the hinge on which a country turned. Copenhagen, 11:26 a.m., Tuesday, 27th of June, 2017. The morning hum inside Maersk's global headquarters sounds like any other. Keyboard chatter, espresso machines, the distant gull-like squawk of cranes loading containers at the harbor. Then, almost playfully, icons begin vanishing from computer screens. Outlook freezes. A finance manager tries a reboot and is greeted by a black banner of Cyrillic text demanding Bitcoin. Down on the quay, a foreman radios the dispatch room. His terminal has gone dark. Can't tell which container is refrigerated insulin and which is lawn furniture. One by one, 600 offices in 130 countries fall silent as NotPetya malware detonates along Maersk's network lines like satchel charges exploding in sync. Half a world away in Singapore, a container ship the length of 3 football fields eases toward its berth, only to find the automated gates locked. Paperwork can't print, cranes stand idle. Refrigerated boxes tick inexorably toward spoilage. In Rotterdam, a truck queue backs onto the highway while clerks rummage for carbon copy manifests no one has used since the 1990s. Globally, a fifth of the planet's seaborne freight, clothes, coffee beans, chemotherapy drugs, hangs in logistical limbo. Søren Skou, Maersk's square-jawed chief executive, hears the first reports while leaving an investor meeting. By the time he reaches his 11th floor office, phone lines have reverted to old-school analog patches through personal mobiles. Digital phones rode the same crippled servers as the laptops. Skou's first instruction is deceptively modest. Find me a whiteboard the size of a wall. If electrons can't talk, ink must. Within 30 minutes, a war room takes shape around that white rectangle. Department heads flood in, some clutching laptops now useful only as glossy paperweights. Skou stands at one edge of the board, sleeves rolled. Situation, he says, marking a column. The CIO sketches the infection's spread. 4,000 servers encrypted, 45,000 PCs useless, email and payroll down. Impact, Skou writes, while another voice catalogs halted ports, offline customer systems, refrigerated cargo at risk, and estimated losses hitting $10 million a day.
We dive, enter through exhaust duct, plant the pulse. Morales patches navigation long enough for Miku to pull us clear. They suited up in wetsuits filched from a tour bus. Night dropped like a curtain, far off, lightning stitched the eastern sky. At Miku's nod, they slipped into black water. Cold swallowed sound. LEDs under the barge belly glowed sickly teal. Samuel pried the exhaust grate. 4 shadows hauled into the duct. Inside, heat and diesel stung lungs. Through a mesh gate, he spotted Eliza cuffed to a support pillar, legs splinted but eyes defiant. Katerina had left her as bait. Bootsteps, Draxler's baritone barking, auction doors open at 0200. Vieco whispered, EMP primed. Samuel eased the valve. Luca slid through, then Samuel, Morales, Vieco. 10 meters to Eliza, then 8. Katerina stepped from a side hatch, pistol raised. One pulse and we drift to Bulgaria. You drown chasing ethics. Samuel kept his weapon low. Release her. Morales will keep your hull off sandbars, nothing more. She weighed the math, then nodded to a guard. Flex cuffs snapped open. Eliza limped to Samuel's side, hand braced on his shoulder. Katerina holstered her pistol. For every server you sink, 2 surface downstream. Then we keep swimming, Samuel said. They retreated. Vieco's thumb hit execute. Silence swallowed hum, lights guttered, servos died. The barge sagged on the river's shrug. Topside, rain slashed sideways. Luca crank-winched a powerless davit. The skiff swung free. Samuel lowered Eliza, followed by the others, and they pushed off as thunder cracked. On the barge roof, a lone figure watched, Katerina, arms folded, memorizing failure for future code. Miku's tug hauled them aboard. Engines roared, bow knifing toward the northern channel as storm clouds swallowed the barge behind. Eliza leaned against a coil of rope, rain cleaning soot from her face. She opened one eye. You over-engineer rescues. I had consultants, Samuel said, tipping his head to Luca. She saluted Luca. He gave a tight nod, feud postponed. Morales fired a green flare into the rain. Color of nonprofit sabotage, he crowed. On deck, Luca spread the cracked tablet Samuel had lifted from the expo. Lines of code scrolled, proof ready for sunrise. Next, we leak everything, Luca said. Daylight seldom forgives, Samuel answered, but it does illuminate. The eastern sky softened, storm moving on. The tug's hum mingled with the slow, deliberate breathing of survivors. Samuel closed his fist around the tablet. Somewhere downstream, servers smoldered, and upriver, New battles waited to be named, but for this moment, the river carried them home. The Danube lay silver flat beneath a bruised sky, the river's skin broken only by the slow churn of a single tug ghosting downcurrent with its running lights dark. 4:12 a.m., Samuel Hollis's field watch declared, less than 20 minutes before dawn thinned the darkness. Ahead, little more than a silhouette of tinted glass and antennae marked the floating data center where fortunes would trade hands and inconvenient witnesses vanished. "Speak, Captain Miku," pipe clenched between weather-cracked teeth, throttled back until the tug's engine idled to a cough. On the deck, Samuel and Luka Stanich knelt in wetsuits, rebreathers clipped to their shoulders, river mist filming their gauges. Luka cinched Samuel's harness, his bandaged arm stiff but sure. 15 minutes submerged. Stay on the tether. Guards hear even a hiccup and they drop weighted nets. Samuel tested the mouthpiece, tasting rubber and rust. Copy. Luka ran a thumb over the fist-sized EMP, concentric coils, battery pack epoxied shut, a kill switch the color of fresh blood. 5-second pulse. Any longer and we fry our ride. 5 seconds, Samuel repeated. Plenty. He held Luca's gaze. Eliza comes out alive. They bumped fists, oath, not gesture, and rolled over the rail. The river was a knife. Sound vanished. Only the metronome of disciplined breathing remained. Maintenance LEDs cast a green halo under the barge's hull. Guided by the descent line, they reached the exhaust duct Vieco had flagged. 0.5 meter wide, fan blades dormant for scheduled servicing. Luca's multi-tool freed the grate, and they wormed inside, shoulders scraping algae-slick steel until the duct angled up and spat them into an engineering sump. Lights off, Samuel listened. Pumps throbbed, coolant hissed, no voices. They slid the grill aside and stepped into a forest of humming server racks. Blue LEDs laddered across Luca's cheekbones, turning him into moving code. Footfalls, two guards in mirrored visors. Samuel melted between towers. Luca rode the first man down in silence. Samuel crushed air from the second with a forearm to the diaphragm. Two bodies, two key cards. "Stairwell aft," Luca whispered, handing over a card. "She'll be near the control spine. Best sightline for leverage." They climbed. Each landing smelled of antiseptic and anxiety. Amber strobes blinked auction pre-checks. Voices drifted from the main deck, multilingual, hungry. Samuel halted on the final step. "Who's bankrolling Katarina in person?" "Armin Sarkozy," Luca breathed, the name like a bruise. "Hungarian venture priest. Sells the region its own bones gilded." Samuel filed the rot. A smart glass corridor let them peer into the showroom. Exoskeletons hung like crucifixes, tungsten limbs flexing for rehearsal. Sarkozy prowled below, silver beard clipped to wolf neatness. Beside him, Dr. Katarina Vukovich in storm gray silk, ruling her kingdom of decimals. Samuel's eyes skipped to the far corner. Eliza Kaleva, ankle-braced in carbon fiber, sat cuffed to a stanchion. Bruises shadowed her face, but her stare mapped every exit. Luca ghosted left, lodging the EMP beneath a raised floor panel. Thumb trembled on the arm switch. "Hot," he murmured. "Your call." "We leak first," Samuel said. The nearer doorway read Observation. His stolen card winked green. Inside, glass railings overlooked the stage. Holographic consoles glowed, already authenticated. He slotted Vieco's microdrive. File trees blossomed, bribe ledgers, casualty audits, contracts scrubbed of war crimes. One tap would duplicate everything to mirror sites worldwide. He hovered over transmit. A soft click of heels. Katarina entered, pistol leveled, gaze unhurried. "Mr. Hollis, always a breath ahead of your competence." Hands raised, Samuel edged from the keyboard. "Pull the plug and every journalist gets the cash by dead man trigger." "Redundancy," she said, gesturing him aside. Below, Luca slashed Eliza's cuffs. Sarkozy spotted the motion, barked in gutter Hungarian. Guards converged, bitters scattered like startled crows. Katarina noticed too late. Eliza rose, drove an elbow through a visor, and disappeared behind a pillar with Luca. Gunfire erupted, glass snowed onto the stage. Katarina's weapon never wavered off Samuel. "Call them off." "Not mine to call." With a knuckle, he tapped enter. The upload bar climbed, 30, 50, 71%. She fired. Sparks spat, progress froze. Samuel dove as a second round shredded the railing. Downstage, Sarkozy pinned Luca behind an exosuit cradle. "Stanich," he roared. "Your sister's rehab runs on my money. Walk away." Luca answered with 4 Balkan syllables and a bullet that shaved Sarkozy's ear. Smoke curled from fried circuitry. Samuel yanked the still glowing data stick, pocketed it and rose empty-handed. Katerina, his voice stayed level. You built miracles, then marked up the price like narcotics. Step back, or the river writes your obituary. She thumbed the safety off. The deck lights died. Luca had triggered the EMP, a soundless flash. Servos seized, LEDs winked out, the barge's hum bled to nothing. Emergency strobes strobed red every 2 seconds. Samuel lunged in the darkness. First frame, Katerina's elbow cracked his jaw. Next frame, he slammed her into a server tower, heard ribs protest under silk. The pistol skittered away. In the failing light, they traded blows until she slipped on cooling water and he pinned her. It's over, he rasped. Nothing ends, she hissed. It iterates. A crash from the stage, Luca tackling Sarkozy. In the strobe, Sarkozy's knife flashed, carving Luca's shoulder. Luca headbutted, heaved, and the Hungarian vanished over the rail, scream cut short by steel 2 stories below. Eliza limped up the stairs, small pistol steady. We leaving? Samuel cuffed Katerina with the same restraints that had held Eliza. Evidence, not mercy. Sprinklers kicked in, cold rain over hot wiring, Luca rejoined, bleeding but upright. Helipad skiffs still live, 5 seats. They hustled through a service corridor. Doors, starved of power, opened a grudging half-meter. Rain slashed the helipad. The skiff waited, aluminum ribs, electric outboard blessedly EM-proof. Samuel shoved Katerina to the bow, zipping her to a cleat. Lightning stitched the horizon. Dawn pressured the clouds. They cast off. The barge dwindled to a sickly bruise behind them. For 5 hushed minutes, only water talked. Eliza touched Samuel's swelling jaw. You look terrible. You should see the other day, he muttered, letting relief ride the joke. Luca's laugh cracked like wet gravel. Data survive? Samuel patted the drive against his ribs. Journalists wake up hungry. And her? Luca nodded at Katerina, who stared at fog as though redesigning it. Speak, agency? Temporary, Samuel said. Truth has to outrun her lawyers. Miku's tug emerged from the mist, deck lights dim. The old captain raised a thermos in salute, took their line and towed them into thicker fog. Exhaustion seeped through bone, yet underneath pulsed something steadier than adrenaline, earned belief. They had crawled into the machine's heart and unplugged it. Tomorrow would still be imperfect, but the world would know whose hands were dirty. The tug angled toward an abandoned boathouse, a dry cot, bitter coffee, a satellite uplink itching to spill everything. Luca lay back, rain drumming his boots. Eliza breathed against Samuel's shoulder, each inhale a reason to continue. Fog folded over river, city, sky. Somewhere inside that pale oblivion waited the next fight, the next iteration. Samuel closed his eyes for 1 heartbeat, opened them, and held on as the horn's mournful note carried them deeper into the waking gray. Morning dragged itself up the Danube like a survivor, all washed out blue and the faint smell of wet ash. Belgrade's skyline looked innocent again, refusing to admit it had spent the night lit by muzzle flashes and burning circuitry. Samuel, Eliza, and Luca disembarked at a half-derelict quay in Zeeman, the same tug that had pulled them out of the auction barge easing away without ceremony. The safe house above the autoglass shop was nothing but whitewash, barred windows, and the oily tang of petrol, perfect for being forgotten. A medic on loan from the Balkan office finished stitching the knife gash in Luca's shoulder. Eliza, ankle taped and throbbing, lounged on a camp cot, eyes moving between the needlework and Samuel's swelling jaw. She'd already refused the painkillers. Vigilance trumped vanity. He sat at a scarred plywood desk, the hard drive from the barge hooked to a secure terminal. Every muscle in his body felt wrung dry, yet a live coal of urgency kept him upright. At 7:05, the monitor stabilized into Director Markovich's face, HQ bustle ghosting behind him. Mr. Hollis, he said, voice pitched low. Last night's sit-rep reads like speculative fiction. Evidence package is mirrored, Samuel replied, pushing gravel from his throat. International Tribunal, Bern, Al Jazeera, minimum redundancies of 5. Markovich exhaled, relief escaping the seams. Interpol snagged 2 buyers sprinting through Vienna Airport. Panic rarely books a good seat, and Dr. Vukovic? En route to central lockup. Samuel resisted calling it safe custody. Men like Sarkozy still had long pockets. Her legal team's building a humanitarian halo. She always did prefer glossy wrappers on sharp objects. The director's gaze sharpened. Field performance exceeds your pay scale. Effective immediately. Operative, grade 3. Except? A humming silence spread through the room. Even the medic's hands hovered midair. Samuel let the weight settle, felt it tilt from imposter syndrome toward earned gravity. I accept, sir. I thought you might. A ghost of a smile. Mr. Stanich? Luca rose, dressing shirt sleeves dark with iodine. Present. Regional command needs a liaison fluent in both dialects and black markets. You're nominated, pending a hospital that won't recycle its gauze. One condition. Luca's chin lifted. My sister walks on tech we confiscated. Signed already, Markovitz said, as if contracts willed themselves. Briefing packet in an hour. Rest while the planet still permits it. The screen cut to black. Fluorescence hummed. Eliza's laugh slipped out, surprised, raw. Congratulations, statistic. You're officially dangerous. Dental still excluded, he muttered, rubbing his bruised jaw. Their fingers brushed. Neither of them moved away. Outside, the city restarted. Scooters coughing to life, storefront shutters rattling up, river traffic growling under bridges. Belgrade pretended to be ordinary, and for a moment they let it. 7 hours later, a borrowed van climbed the switchbacks to Avala Rehabilitation Center, a slab of modernism staring down fruit orchards in the capital beyond. Inside the physio gym, Anna Stanich waited in carbon braces that ended at her mid-thighs. Hair buzzed, eyes flinty, she looked like someone who had buried pain deep enough to farm it. Luca approached, guilt written in every slowed step. Nora. Bring an apology and I'll feed it to the shredder, she said, arms crossed. I brought an upgrade. He waved Morales forward. The engineer navigated a dolly carrying the stripped-down exoskeleton they had salvaged, a war machine detoxed for healing. Ana's skepticism could have cracked marble. That thing murdered a dozen procurement regs. Now it rewrites them. Morales's voice was pure Midwest professor. Civilian torque limits. Safety watchdogs on every servo. You move, it helps. No surprises. Nurses clipped her in. Motors chirped. Braces took the weight. At first, nothing. Then a shift, small, uncertain, and the exo answered. One step, another, a pivot so careful it felt like prayer. Ana's breath caught. She looked up at her brother, eyes bright and furious with hope. You steal any more state secrets, you'd better bring coffee too. Hospital sludge is treason. Luca's reply tangled in his throat. He only nodded, and the room filled with a silence denser than applause. Samuel turned away, blinking hard toward the windows, where late light fractured over the orchards. He felt the perimeter where damage meets repair, and how thin that border can be. Back in Zeman, dusk painted everything copper. Eliza brewed Turkish coffee thick enough to stand a spoon, while Samuel chased the last encrypted cul-de-sacs on the hard drive. Most were predictable, shell companies, bribe ledgers, but one directory partners refused to yield. Biometric lock, unknown owner. Eliza set a steaming cup beside him. Retina gate, she said. Our best bets are Vukovic or Sarkozy if he survived the fall. Or someone we haven't met, Samuel answered. The folder throbbed in the corner of the screen like a wound that wouldn't clot. A news bulletin blinked on the muted television. Vukovic denied bail, claims technology eaten by lesser minds. Reporters swarmed the courthouse steps. Katerina's chin remained imperial. She'll stage manage her martyrdom, Eliza said, arms folded. Let her. Luca lowered himself to the couch, shoulder stiff. Spotlights fry silent investors faster than indictments. Samuel nodded, but kept staring at the locked folder. Instinct said the real puppeteer lived inside that data. Near midnight, the agency back channel lit up. São Paulo Customs flagged an inbound crate matching Belgrade serial numbers. Lagos seized medical devices containing cobalt joints. Taipei showed a container diverted to a biomech fab with laughable security. Three continents, one handwriting. He printed the manifests, tacked them over a wall map. Luca whistled low. Hydra strategy. Chop one head, two ship elsewhere. Or the real head never surfaced, Samuel said, gaze sliding to partners. The cursor blinked back, patient. They dozed where they landed, Luca snoring under a magazine, Morales propped over schematics, Eliza curled next to a half-charged tablet, Samuel on the floor beneath a ceiling fan tracing lazy circles. Promotion? Liability? Unfinished business spinning together until exhaustion smothered thought. Sunday smelled like fresh bread and engine grease. They climbed five flights to a rooftop cafe overlooking the confluence where Sava folds into Danube. Rusted barges, mirrored cruise boats, minarets, cranes, Belgrade's mismatched diary spread out below. The proprietor, a woman with skin like droughted soil, served espresso in chipped enamel, then returned to her crossword. For a rare stretch, they said nothing. Wind carried church bells from the old quarter. Gulls argued over whatever floated. Luca finally spoke. When I was 13, I stole a fishing skiff to impress a girl. Engine died midstream. I thought the river would decide my fate. He smiled sideways. Last night felt the same, but at least I trusted the crew. Eliza toasted him. Next time we aim for calm water. Samuel's agency phone buzzed, a single encrypted ping. Osiris Protocol, São Paulo, Lagos, Taipei. Field teams mobilize 48 HRs. Request Hollis Kaleva Stonich for shadow liaison. Brief 2100 Zulu. Rendezvous 44.812 degrees N, 20.4596 E. Timer active. 43 minutes left. He passed the phone. Luca grunted approval. Shadow liaison, better than fugitive mechanic. Eliza drained her cup. Set it down with the click of a spent cartridge. I promised myself a week off. Apparently I lied. Samuel slipped a coin beneath their cups, the old ritual of paying before departure. Redemption's on installment. Interest never sleeps. Luca rose, flexing patched muscles. Let's negotiate late fees en route. They headed for the iron stair, posters for forgotten bands flapping around them. Halfway down, Samuel paused, catching one last view of the rivers, smooth, almost innocent. He knew the turbulence that lived beneath. Statistic? Eliza asked. He inhaled diesel, pastry, morning newsprint, the scent of a city waking to its own contradictions. Ready. Boots met pavement. The city's pulse folded them in. Somewhere 6 blocks away, a clock was already ticking. Farther out, new warehouses rattled with unlicensed machinery. Further still, continents waited. They moved toward all of it, three silhouettes woven into the restless weave of streets. Behind them, the cafe radio cracked into a Motown refrain the city barely heard, its lyrics sliding east on the wind, keeping pace with the slow, relentless river. Thank you for choosing A Story Publishing.